You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're broadcasting live from Florida State University in Tallahassee today as part of their Origins 09 conference. And the conference marks 200 years since the birth of Charles Darwin and 150 since the publication of On the Origin of Species, the book that unveiled Darwin's new theory on evolution. But this hour, we're going to talk about origins going much further, way back than the appearance of even the earliest species. I'm talking about the origin of the universe. How did all of this get started? Everything that we see around us, how did it all get here? Where did it come from? Where did the forces of nature come from? I'm getting just out of breath thinking about it. So stuff we take for granted, for example, like gravity. My next guest, Dr. Lisa Randall, has been thinking, researching, and writing about these mysteries, and she has formulated some interesting explanations for them. And those explanations include the existence of extra dimensions. A la Rod Serling, where are you? This is really interesting stuff and might make you think that we're talking about science fiction, but we're not. And if you'd like to talk with us about that, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And we have almost 10,000 Twitterers on our Twitter, tweeting us these days, and you can join the Twitterers at the @ followed by SciFry if you'd like to do that. Also in Second Life, we have our avatars having a meeting out there and sending in questions to us. Lisa Randall is the author of Warp Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. She's also a professor of physics at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me here.
Good to see you. You're here for the Origins Conference. How much do we really know about the origin of the universe? How much is speculation? Give us a little update on that.
Well, you know, it's a little bit ironic that the title is Origins, because what we know about is evolution. Mm-hmm. We know about how things have changed over time. But what we don't actually know, I will confess right from the beginning, is how things started. We don't understand the very first moments. But we do have an incredibly precise and detailed theory of how the universe has come to evolve over time, the Big Bang theory, coupled with something called cosmological inflation. Mm-hmm. So we know the universe began as some hot plasma that's cooled down over time. We can see evidence of the radiation in the sky and look at that radiation, and it tells us detailed properties of what the universe looked like earlier on. We can see evidence that the universe is expanding. We can see evidence that actually detailed nuclear abundances. So right. It's a very precise theory.
Yeah. But one of the great mysteries of the universe is why we only can see 4% of it, right? Isn't 96% of the universe?
You're jumping right into the stuff we don't know.
Dark stuff? Well, I mean, we talk about this all the time. I mean, I love to talk about this, you know, the dark energy and the dark matter.
Well, yeah, it's got good names, so people love to talk about it. But it's true. So we have this great theory. It works. But the fact is, we don't know.
How could it work if we don't know what 96% of the universe is made of? You know, well, it's like I sell you a toaster and I say, well, it doesn't work for 96% of the time, but that 4% of the time, it's a great toaster.
But for you to get your toaster to work, all you need to do is press that button. Right. You don't need the detailed properties. And in the same way, we have dark matter and dark energy out there, and we know what its gravitational properties are. And we know some things about it being weakly interacting so that we haven't seen it. So we know enough about its properties that we can actually determine how it's affected the universe's evolution. But we don't know fundamentally what it is. If it's a particle, what is its mass? What are its other interactions other than gravity? So we see the gravitational effects, but we don't know what else there is.
And one of the holy grails of physics has been to try to unite all the different particles and forces of nature, right? We have particles, we have forces, we have objects, and we have forces, and trying to unite all of them. And it has not, it's worked pretty well, except possibly for just getting gravity in there, right? It just refuses to bend.
Well, actually, gravity makes things bend quite a bit.
That was a bad choice of words. I knew when it came out of my mouth.
But actually, we have made progress. We don't know for a fact that things are unified. And again, this gets back to this question of sort of origins versus late-stage evolutions. We understand a lot about forces. We understand that if we can track them back to how strong they would have been at higher energies, that actually it looks like they might have unified. Mm-hmm. They could have had the same strength. We don't know for a fact that this has happened. We haven't seen experimental evidence, for example, through proton decay, but there is evidence that this could have been true, and the way matter organizes itself, it looks like it's true. It doesn't obviously work with gravity. Gravity looks different, but particularly in these extra-dimensional theories, which we can go into later,
yeah.
It does look like there's a possibility that all of this can fit together, at least in a higher-dimensional universe. So it's something that's a little bit beyond what we really have know in detail experimentally, but there is theoretical motivation to think that this might have happened.
Well, let's talk about gravity a bit more, because you talk about it in your book and in writings as one of the great mysteries about gravity is why you can have a refrigerator magnet hold that little note up on the refrigerator, yet you have the whole mass of the Earth tugging in the opposite directions, and it can't pull that little note off the refrigerator.
Right.
It's so weak, it can't even do that. And that's something that you have been exploring.
And the fact that, you know, we can raise our arms and jump up and down. We have the entire Earth acting on us. But the point is that gravity as a fundamental force, that is to say, if I took two elementary particles, an electron and positron, or two electrons, and asked about the relative strength of gravity and electromagnetism, gravity is far, far weaker, over 40 orders of magnitude weaker. It's an extremely weak force at a fundamental level. And that is one of the puzzles that we face as particle physicists. Why should gravity be so much weaker than the other forces that we know about? And even if you're willing to just grant me that, okay, there's this incredibly tiny number that exists, it almost seems inconsistent, and this is why we pay so much attention to it. If you put together quantum mechanics and special relativity, and you ask about what those two theories together tell us, we would expect that gravity should be comparable in strength to these other forces. Now, we can adjust parameters. We can put in what we call a fine-tuning.
You could cheat. No.
It's almost a cheat.
Yeah.
I mean, it technically it works,
yeah.
But everyone knows that it's more like a placeholder.
Okay, I'll go with that word instead.
Yeah. Everyone knows that there should be some explanation for that.
Right.
And that's what really motivates a lot of our thinking now, because there's this puzzle. It exists.
Mm.
We know there should be some more satisfying resolution, and that's what's led us to some of these more interesting theories.
And
that
this
interest, about.
And one of your ways of resolving this, saying there are not just four dimensions here, there's a fifth dimension. Let me see if I get this right, and you'll tell me, I'm sure you'll tell me I've got it all wrong. It says that the reason that gravity is weak is because we're feeling only a small part of the force of gravity, because it resides next to us, unseen in a different dimension, in a fifth dimension. And it just slightly comes into our dimension. Did I do that justice at all?
That's not too far
not
off.
Not too far off.
So before I talk about this, I want to say that this puzzle of the weakness of gravity is a puzzle that's plagued particle physics for years, ever since we put together what's known as the standard model of particle physics. Just like for cosmology, we really do know quite a bit. In particle physics, we know quite a bit. But this puzzle about explaining the weakness of gravity has been around for years, and physicists have puzzled over it. And there are some potential explanations without invoking an extra dimension of space, but they're not entirely satisfying, which is one of the reasons it made sense to think about, could it be explained in another dimension? And what Ramachandran and I found is that if there is another dimension, you can have gravity essentially concentrated in another dimension. It's actually not that far away, because it decreases so quickly as you go away from that region where it's concentrated, that if you're anywhere except at that place, you could find that gravity is naturally very weak.
Is that dimension all around us? We just don't see it?
I mean, that gravity, it could be everywhere.
Is it next to us? Is it above us? Is it surround us?
Well,
these
that's
two
always
simple
the
questions, right?
Very simple.
They're just too simple for my little mind.
The problem is that, I mean, when we think about extra dimensions, of course, we all get puzzled because we don't see those extra dimensions, we don't feel them, we don't experience them. And the fact is, we don't know if that's a function of the way we are, how we see things. For example, it could be that the way we see is through photons. Maybe they don't go through the extra dimension. So maybe we can only see the dimensions that we know of, the three. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. And one of the things that we do as physicists is say, suppose that was there. Is it consistent with what we've seen so far? And it's completely consistent to have an extra dimension that we haven't yet observed.
Is it possible to find that dimension?
That's a great question. And what we can find, if this explanation of the weakness of gravity is correct, we can find evidence that the extra dimension exists. And it would be not by looking directly into the extra dimension, but by having it sort of come to us, in the sense that there could be extra particles that essentially travel in the extra dimension. They have momentum associated with the extra dimensions. But what we would see are particles that look like the ones we know about, that is to say they interact in similar ways, but they're heavier because they have this momentum from the extra dimension.
They're given the momentum from the extra dimension.
Essentially.
And we watch them cross over here.
Well, we would just see them as particles. We would say, look, there's a heavy particle. Oh, but look at that. It has properties very similar to particles we know about. And in fact, you can look at detailed properties and say, you know, maybe that particle is associated with gravity. And it's by doing detailed tests of looking at what we see that we can say, does this particle spectrum agree with what you would predict if there was an extra dimension?
And how would we see the particle if it's in the other dimension?
There's the rub.
No, there's not a rub. No. We're all looking forward to it because we're hoping that the Large Hadron Collider, otherwise known as the LHC, this giant accelerator that will hopefully turn on this year, located near Geneva, Switzerland, is going to collide together beams of protons at incredibly high energy. Now, why high energy? Because E equals mc squared. So if I have high energy, I can make particles that have higher mass m. And these particles that have this mass from the extra dimension, or any other particle associated with this, explaining this weakness of gravity, should be able to be produced there. And so there will be incredibly detailed experiments that look for, when those proton beams collide, what comes out. Mm-hmm. What comes out that's new that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
So you'll be looking for those particles.
I won't be looking, but looking forward to my experimental colleagues looking for that.
Experiment, and that will that prove it or just suggest that you're on the right trail?
Well, you know, there's this question of proof in science is always a slippery slope because, as you know, we prove things with some probability. Right. We say there's some confidence level in what we see. So we will be able to, we won't be able to absolutely prove, but we will be able to get to be able to show that there is very strong evidence or not very strong evidence for any particular theory.
We'll come back and talk more with Lisa Randall, author of Warp Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. Also, we'll take your questions here in our audience and also on 1-800-989-8255 is our number. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here in Tallahassee, talking with Lisa Randall, who is author of Warp Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. She's also a professor of physics at Harvard University. And she was telling us that there will be hopefully some experiments happening at the Large Hadron Collider, which is really a big underground ring at the border, the French border there in Switzerland. And what part, if we find a particle, it'll give us some idea that possibly your idea is correct. Is there one particle in particular that you're looking for?
Well, I just want to emphasize that they're looking for whatever solves the weakness of gravity. They're looking for a Higgs particle that will explain how particles acquire mass, and they're going to try to find whatever explains the weakness of gravity. If the warped geometry that Raman and I worked on is the answer, the particle they might find would be what's called a Kaluza-Klein mode of the graviton.
So beg your pardon. I have a tissue here.
Exactly.
Say that again?
So the graviton is the particle that communicates gravity. It's analogous to a photon that communicates the force of electromagnetism. That is to say, charged particles exchange a photon. Every massive particle exchanges gravitons.
Mm-hmm.
A Kaluza-Klein partner of a graviton is a particle that's like the graviton, that is to say it interacts with everything that has mass or energy, but it's heavier. And it's heavier because it has extra-dimensional momentum. Mm-hmm. So it's a particle that really is associated with the existence of extra dimensions, whose properties we understand.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to our audience microphone. Yes, sir.
Dr. Randall, I'm a big fan, just first off.
Thank you.
The question I have for you is, you've spoken of fifth-dimensional space. I know mathematically they've shown there's many more dimensions beyond this. I believe up to 13 at less count. How do these additional dimensions jive with your model?
Yes, that was my next question. String theory talks about all these dimensions. You're only talking about one more dimension at a time.
So let me explain, first of all, what I do. I don't strictly do string theory. I'm trying to understand how the properties of our universe can be explained through theoretical ideas such as those that emerge from string theory. So I don't necessarily need the full panoply of whatever is in string theory. We can say there might be an extra dimension. What would its effect be? If there are these other dimensions, they obviously have to be hidden, just like the fifth one does, the fifth dimension of space-time. And it could be that they're curled up in a tiny size. It could be that they're warped. One of the other things that Raman and I showed is that an extra dimension could be hidden because it's extremely warped. So obviously, if these other dimensions are there, they have to be hidden in some way. However, we're really focusing on what plays a role in what we can observe, what we can explain about our universe and what we can observe. And that's why we're just concentrating on this fifth space-time dimension.
Mm. What a great name for a group. Fifth dimension. Never work. Never going to work. Let's go to the phones to...
I have the album cover in my office.
I'll bet you do. Framed, not alone. Let's go to Taver in Tucson. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi. Are you there? Go ahead.
I just had a question. You know, you think about like electromagnetism, which I know you were comparing to gravity in ways, but it being weaker. But electromagnetism having, you know, a positive and negative force. Is there any evidence, be it observed or theoretical, that gravity has, you know, two sides of its force, being, or maybe polar, like electromagnetism?
Well, one of the other great mysteries that we sort of started to allude to about the universe is the fact that we now know that the acceleration of the universe is actually accelerating. And that is, in some sense, accounted for by, in some sense, what people would call a repulsive gravitational force. It looks like it has a different sign. Really, we understand it in terms of a different type of matter or energy distribution. That's what we call the dark energy that would accelerate it. But you can, in some sense, think of that as being having an opposite sign.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the next person at the microphone. Yes.
Dr. Randall, I have a very simple question, but I don't think the answer is very simple. Have physicists decided whether the universe is finite or infinite yet? Is there any way laymen can understand why this controversy goes on? And is there any way to explain it? My students are constantly asking this.
Okay, so the first answer is no. I guess we haven't decided. The second answer is...
That's pretty fast.
Yeah. Okay. The second answer is, yes, there's a reason. We can understand why we can't decide this, because we actually only see a finite part of the universe. We know now that the speed of light is finite, and we know the universe has existed, as far as we know, for 13.6 billion years. So we can only see out that far into the universe. Beyond that, we don't know what happens. There's no evidence that it's finite. And I'd say that as physicists, we don't actually spend a whole lot of time debating that because we concentrate on things that are experimentally observable. So people have asked if it's finite over observable scales, and there's no evidence for that.
Thanks for the question. When the Big Bang started, at that moment of the explosion, was it traveling faster than the speed of light?
No.
No. Okay. Just thought I'd throw that out because everybody keeps asking me and I keep saying no. And I said, I'll ask Lisa Randall. She'll tell me that answer right tonight. Okay, yes. Question.
Hello, Ms. Randall. I'm Ari Octon, and I have a three-part question for you. First of all, since the universe is constantly expanding, will it ever stop? And how can it keep expanding? Second, since to expand, you need to expand into some space around you, what does the universe expand into? And that space, do you think that we can access that space from wormholes and black holes, and maybe it might be another universe or parallel world?
Okay, first of all, it's Professor Randall. Second of all, we know what's driving the expansion is the fact that there is energy throughout the universe, and that produces a gravitational field, and that determines how the universe evolves. And it's often a common misconception that the universe has to evolve into something. The universe is, by definition, everything there is. So the universe can be expanding, and we tend to think of it because we're familiar with pictures of something expanding into something else. But a better picture is if you sort of imagine it maybe as the surface of a balloon, that where the balloon itself is expanding. Now, and forget about the outside, just think of the balloon as the universe. So the universe itself can be expanding, but you shouldn't think of it as expanding into something else.
You know, what strikes me is having read a lot of historical science, this is the exact same questions that Albert Einstein was asked 75 years ago. By kids who used to write him letters and he used to write back with the same sort of questions. We're still asking those same questions.
And actually, I mean, Einstein was perplexed by the fact that his solution, when you solve the solutions to the equations of motion, it looked like you had an expanding universe. That's what he tried to fudge to try to make it static, because at that point there was no evidence of an expanding universe. I mean, it's really amazing how recent that discovery is, late 1920s, we found out the universe is expanding.
And what is even more astounding to me, who follows this sort of thing, is that the expansion did not happen at the beginning of these. It only kicked in a few billion years ago. That the rapid expansion, from at least from what I read, it was like only 5 or 8 billion years ago that the force was observed. If you put it backwards. Now you'll say I'm incorrect, but I'm happy to hear it.
I mean, we have a detailed theory of how it expands, and maybe you're referring to the period of exponential expansion.
I'm referring to the dark energy.
Oh, you're referring to the dark energy.
The
fact that the dark energy...
Didn't kick in until just a few billion years ago.
Well, the dark energy kicked in rather recently.
Yeah.
And that's less surprising. Well, it's coincidental in some sense that it's recent, and that's one of the mysteries. Why should it be taking over now? But the fact that eventually dark energy takes over is less mysterious, because dark energy is something that just sits there throughout time. So even if there's a tiny amount of dark energy, as you can imagine, as things expand, radiation dilutes, matter dilutes, everything else dilutes, but the dark energy just sits there. So at some point, the dark energy will win, even no matter how small it started relative to the, as long as there's something around.
And we have no idea what that energy is.
Well, in some sense, it's even hard to ask what we mean by asking what that energy is. I mean...
I said 96%.
I sound like I'm cheating. I know. It's only 70%. 25% is dark matter.
We know how
to think about dark matter.
Okay.
Dark energy, there's another mystery, which is just why isn't it enormously bigger? I mean, according to, again, that same thing, the quantum mechanics and special relativity, we expect to have energy that just sits there. I mean, that's one of the things that Einstein taught us, that the absolute value of energy is meaningful. Mm-hmm. I mean, before that, high school class, you learn about relative energies. But the absolute energy is meaningful, too, because it determines the evolution of the universe. And understanding why that value is what it is a big mystery.
1-800-989-8255. Yes, another question out there.
My name is Marie, and I have a question to Dr. Rendell. Well, to get it a little bit distracted from physics, I have a question about women in science. And you being a woman, you probably asked that many, many times, but I'm still wondering that you can tell us how it is for you being a woman in physics. Usually physics is dominated by men, and maybe it's not true anymore. Maybe it was 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Does it play to your advantage or vice versa? Or maybe you can recall some funny stories explaining and we're not taking seriously.
We only have a half hour left, so we can't go through all of them. Go ahead.
I don't know where to start to answer that question.
What's it like to be a woman physicist? Let's start with the first one. Is it?
You know, it's the only thing I've ever been. It's still unusual. I mean, it's still mostly men, but it's the only thing I've ever been. I mean, you do the science, and you hope that suffices. I mean, of course, there are situations where it's unusual. Like, for example, this one, where I'd rather be answering a question about science than I'm answering a question about this. But there's no simple answer. I mean, there's a long conversation to be had. But and I'm not saying that it's a simple thing, and I'm not saying that it's easy.
Maybe write a book and get it out of the way.
You know, I thought it was much better actually to write a book about science and just say, you know, there are women doing science. I thought that was much more important.
Okay. Well, let me ask you another off-topic question, but I think it's very much relevant in the news these days. And President Obama says he wants to restore science to its proper place. Where do you see that proper place?
Actually, it's very nice you gave me that lead-in, because when people from the NSF found out I was going to be on the show, they said, you know, could you put in a plug for basic science? Because it's actually appalling how ill-funded basic science is. I mean, you know, when I was told that, I said, well, can I get some numbers? And the amount of money that goes into the kind of research we do through the NSF and through the DOE is amazingly small. And last year it decreased. And, you know, this is how we produce the next generation of at least some of the great thinkers, the people who think scientifically. And it's very easy to get, you know, when we think about the short term, to think about immediate solutions. But we're thinking about big questions that take a long time, but it's also a way of thinking about the world that clearly has been useful to us over the years. And I think one can't emphasize enough how important basic science is and how important it is to keep supporting it over time.
Doesn't that put the responsibility on you as a scientist and other scientists to be able to explain to the public what you do and the importance of it?
And that is one of the reasons that I thought it was important to try to write a book or to try to be in places like this to explain it, because it's very nice for us all to understand. And of course, the excitement of science is doing the science and sharing it with your colleagues, but it's also exciting to find out that there are all these people out here who want to know what you're doing and they want to understand it. And it doesn't mean that everyone is obligated to understand it, but if people want to know why this is exciting, what's happening, what it means, they should be. That information should be out there, mm-hmm. and I thought it was important to communicate it. Mm-hmm.
So we only have a few minutes left in this segment. Where do you yourself go now? You wait. Do you wait for these experiments to produce some results? And
we don't wait.
You don't wait. You're just moving on to the next.
Well, so what are we thinking about now? We're thinking about ways of. So we interact with the experiments in the sense of we try to think about first of all, what they should look for in the terms of what models we build, how they should look. Are there experiments they're not doing that they should be doing, or is there a way to stretch their capabilities? So we're thinking about that. A lot of us in particle physics are also thinking about cosmological issues these days. Dark matter is very exciting. I'll talk about that in the talk later tonight. But right now is a very exciting time for dark matter, and there does seem to be perhaps a connection between dark matter and the scales that will be studied at the Large Hadron Collider, so it's important to understand what the implications of particle physics could be for cosmology and vice versa.
So we might get some dark matter particles out of the Large Hadron Collider?
It's conceivable that we will at least understand what is the overall theory in which the dark matter particle resides, and if we're very lucky, actually, there could be evidence of the dark matter particle.
So this is an exciting time to be a physicist.
It is an exciting time to be a physicist. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I'm in the wrong business. Thank you very much, Dr. Randall,
taking
time to be with us today. Lisa Randall is author of Warp Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. We're here in the Tallahassee on Science Friday from NPR News.